The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, everybody, welcome to Capital Thinking. Hope you are surviving the snowpocalypse or whatever we're calling the storm today. We've got a good show for you, despite the elements. Many guests joining us from the Washington, D.C. area. We're going to talk a little bit about mortgage reform near the bottom of the hour. We're also going to talk about the latest and greatest on health care reform. But we're going to start off by talking about a subject of great interest to those of you who are small businessmen and perhaps concerned about balancing out the job of training your employees, but not training them so well that perhaps they want to leave and take their knowledge and compete against you in the future. Joining us to talk about a unique case that they recently won are two sharp litigators from Washington, D.C., Ben Chu and Michael Giffray. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. And Ben, why don't we start off with you and tell us a little bit about this case that we're here to discuss today.
Well, thank you, Kevin. We're actually calling it Snowtorious down here on M Street. But this case was involved, we represented a company, a minority-owned information management business that suffered a substantial loss when two of our former employees stole a Census Bureau contract worth more than $5 million. We went through discovery, conducted a five-day jury trial, after which, but before the jury came in, the defendants offered an amount far exceeding anything that we had talked about before trial.
Very interesting. And what made this case unique?
Two things, Kevin. One was legally, there was no non-compete agreement governing these two employees, even though they were highly placed employees who were responsible for tracking business opportunities, which created a legal challenge, which we'll discuss in a minute. And secondly, the factual fact pattern made it difficult in the sense that this particular opportunity that the two employees stole was never put on any of their tracking reports. So we had to overcome their defense that this was not an opportunity that belonged to the company. But fortunately, we were able to do that.
Yeah, you say they were highly placed employees. What are you talking, C-level employees or the director level?
They were high-level employees. They were not directors, but they were high-level employees.
I see. Well, Michael, let's turn to you and let's talk a little bit about overcoming the problem that Ben mentioned. The defendants didn't have employment contracts that prohibited them from competing against their employer in this case, right?
That's correct. And, you know, it sounds obvious, but it is not clear-cut that an employee cannot compete against his or her employer. In some jurisdictions, only corporate officers and directors have a fiduciary duty not to compete against their employer. We were fortunate in this case because we found precedent in Maryland that extended this duty of loyalty to all employees. But even with this general prohibition against competing against your employer, an employee can still prepare to compete. And, you know, with that distinction, which can sometimes be fuzzy, it's clear that employees can go on and do interviews. They can incorporate competing businesses. In our case, we had to prove the difficult proposition that the defendants did not just prepare to compete. They actually crossed the line by meeting with Census Bureau contracting officials before they formally resigned from their jobs in order to land this government contract.
Now, you mentioned there was precedent in Maryland. Does that mean other states don't have that same extension of fiduciary duty to all employees?
Each state has a little bit of a unique set of precedent, and that's really what we were governed by here. There was no clear statute in place. As a result, you have to wade through many court opinions to try to figure out what the law is, and then hope that whatever court you're in, whatever judge you have, applies the law in the way you view it. And that made this much more difficult here, even though we ultimately prevailed, because it was a longer and more expensive process than the company otherwise would have had to face if it had employment contracts in place that contain non-competition agreements. And ultimately, we created law in Maryland by convincing the Maryland Court of Special Appeals to enforce what it determined was an implied employment contract. But we had to convince the court that it was okay to take a stance that was contrary to the general American principle that our society favors free competition.
Very interesting. Ben, let's turn back to you. I mean, I think a lot of the folks who listen to this show are small business operators or folks that are in the executive suites of larger companies, and there has to be some lessons learned here. If you're not in the state of Maryland, you're maybe worried about how this fiduciary duty applies to employees. What are the lessons that were learned in this process for other companies?
Kevin, I think the lessons are to take a hard look at the existing non-compete provisions in their employment contracts, and that this date and time, most companies do have non-competes for their key employees, particularly those involved in business acquisition. But I think they should take a hard look at the existing language, and if there is no language there that deals with conduct during employment, we would recommend, based on this case, rather than trying to make new law, put some language in there that deals with the employee's conduct during the employment period, so that is covered, and that if the employee engages in disloyal conduct, such as we had in this case, going out and trying to identify and steal business opportunities, that in fact the employer then has a remedy not only for breach of contract, but it also would support its common law claim for breach of the duty of loyalty, because they could point to specific language in the contract that talks about prescribed conduct. So I'd strongly recommend that to all of our business clients.
And is it also a case, I mean, how far down do you go inside the company to actually sign these sort of non-compete clauses?
Kevin, that's a great question, and I think it has to be taken on a case-by-case basis, but as lawyers, we always want to be overly cautious. So I would say that anybody who conceivably is in a position of any authority or could do any harm, we would recommend going down pretty far.
So essentially, I mean, these guys seem to be sort of salespeople, if you will. It may be that key salespeople in the company should be covered by these types of things if they have access to go out and start their own venture that would directly compete with you based on the knowledge they had while working for you?
Absolutely.
Interesting. Well, I know there were some other issues that you guys faced in the trial that were worthy of discussion. Michael, you want to talk a little bit about what some of those technology issues were?
Yes, actually, this was rather interesting, and it's consistent with the general development of litigation that we've seen over the last decade, where parties have gone from producing documents in paper to, an electronic age where everything is done by email. And we were fortunate that we were able to obtain some original Microsoft Word documents that were fraudulent resumes and other documents that had been prepared by the defendants that were contained within their email. And during the trial, we effectively established that the defendants had lied about their employment status by educating the jury about how Microsoft Word tracks changes made to a document by each author. And by showing the defendants made particular changes to their resumes, we convinced the jury that they knowingly engaged in fraudulent conduct. Exposing the defendant's electronic fingerprints on documents led to a very successful outcome. But it's interesting coming at it from this approach, because often when you are working on documents, you don't think about the other context in which track changes and your changes might be, viewed. And it's a very powerful tool for a company to make sure it understands what its employees are doing.
Now, that's a very curious. My question there, and following up, Michael, is, were those documents things that they were working on that were on the company-owned computer systems, or things that they worked on at home, or a combination thereof? Because I often know that, you know, people have perhaps an overly optimistic sense of privacy about personal documents they work on at a computer system that's owned by the corporation they work for.
Yes, in this case, it was a combination of both corporate and private email that became relevant and produced in discovery. But you hit the nail on the head. Along with the development litigation of focusing on electronic versions of documents, there was a host of issues that we see reported in the news just about every day about employees expecting their email, their work email, to be private. And as an employer, it's important to know that the law, again, is not clear-cut. It's developing in this area, and employers can do a lot to protect themselves by including notices in things like employee handbooks or employment contracts that their email is not considered to be private, subject to monitoring, and you need to make sure the language is carefully drafted to avoid problems in that regard. But it gives you that additional leverage if, in fact, an employee breaches a duty of loyalty, to be able to use that email to protect the company's interests without an extended legal battle over whether or not there's a privacy interest in that email.
Interesting. Well, I've got time for about one more question here. And Ben, Michael, I want to come back to one thing you talked about, you know, putting this tougher language into non-competes. Let's say I work for Acme Corporation. I already have, a contract with my employer that dictates what I can and can't do if I leave. You're suggesting that it needs to be beefed up. How do you have that conversation as an employer with an employee like me to convince me to sign something that's new and protects the employer more in this environment?
Well, usually, Kevin, that requires some additional consideration. So it would be usually in the context of if the employee is re-upping for another year of employment, the employer would be well advised to provide some additional consideration, i.e. some additional money, to support the additional requirement that's being put into the non-compete. Otherwise, as you suggest, there's no incentive for the employee to accept the additional obligation, and arguably it'd be a basis for the employee to challenge it for lack of consideration. Because it's a definite right to the employer.
I would also add that you can look at employee handbooks and modifying them on a regular basis. Just make sure that, unlike in this case with an employee handbook, that you have your employee not only sign acknowledging receipt of the handbook, but also acknowledging that they understand and agree with the terms contained in the employee handbook.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there. Ben Chu and Michael Giuffre, our guests for this segment. If you want more information, check out our website for their bios and contacts. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about healthcare reform.
Thank you, Kevin.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Boom.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics.
We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. As usual, we like to talk about health care reform. The patient may be on the table and maybe close to death, but we do everything we can to make sure you're informed about what's going on with efforts to revive it and get it through Congress this year. Joining us for this segment is one of the deans of the healthcare lobbying world in Washington, D.C., John Jonas, a frequent guest here on Capital Thinking. And John is calling in from his home, where he is apparently snowed in, but hasn't yet run out of alcohol or good times, I hope, there, John. I hope that the power's not out on you or anything in your neck of the woods.
Hot chocolate we're drinking.
Hot chocolate. Oh, okay. All right. It's a family show. That's right. It's only just now noon here on the East. Well, John, I understand that President Obama has invited the Republicans down to the White House for a televised event to negotiate on health care reform, perhaps a way for him to make up for his failure to deliver on the campaign promise to televise every last negotiation on health care reform last year. He's gotten a lot of flack about that. What do you make of all that and this plan for Republicans and Democrats to sit down in the West Wing and negotiate on health care reform?
Well, probably first of all, it's a lesson in making a lot fewer campaign promises when you run, because people, I guess, have a nasty habit of remembering those and holding you to them, or at least the press does. So maybe our presidential candidates will make fewer of them. But he definitely did promise to try and change the tone in Washington. But he put forth a very ambitious health care bill, a bill that probably ultimately suffers from a bridge too far-ism, if I can use that expression. Probably the Massachusetts election and the absence of a 60-vote majority made clear what was probably already a fact, which was the bill was probably just too ambitious for the American public, and the American public wanted probably a less ambitious bill and a more bipartisan bill. So I think the president has heard that message loud and clear. Now, as both Republicans and Democrats know, bipartisanship is relatively difficult to achieve, because what it essentially means is Democrats giving up on part of their agenda, which may be a relatively expansive agenda to expand coverage, and Republicans may have to give up on part of their agenda, which is to focus on tax credits and other things as a way to stimulate health care coverage. And you'd have to have a bipartisan bill, would have to have some sort of combinations of those. And
yeah, I love the president sort of has put Republicans in a little bit of a box. You say you want a seat at the table, here's your seat at the table. It makes it very difficult for them to continue to say no to everything when they're being given the opportunity to present their ideas and let the American public compare and contrast them. So, John, Is there some common ground when these guys sit down? What is this? This is two weeks from now, I believe they're going to sit down and talk in Washington. Is there common ground that they could actually reach a deal on?
As you said, Kevin, it's a lot more fun to throw snowballs maybe than build a snowman or the igloo. It's more work. Yeah, I think there really is common ground. I think you really could, if there is a fair amount of goodwill and a little bit of willingness to give politically, you can find common ground. I think there's a sense that there's a fair amount you can do to address some of the payment problems in Medicare. I think there's a broad view that something should be done in terms of health insurance coverage by removing some of the barriers in terms of pre-existing conditions. There's a variety of different things you can do, and I think the Republicans have a number of good ideas on this in terms of incentivizing businesses to provide coverage, even if we're not going to mandate it. Through tax credits and other relief. The hard part, I think, comes in how do you pay for this in a narrow budget environment. There really aren't any extra dollars. So either you're squeezing the existing health care programs like Medicare, Medicaid, or you're squeezing the tax system a little bit, and neither of those are very popular, let's face it.
Yeah, definitely not. That's a good transition, though. I want to ask you a couple questions about that. It states have their own crisis that continues unabated, regardless of the failure to get a bill passed at this point, and that regards Medicaid funding and how they have to put up their own money and how that continues to grow beyond anybody's expectations. So how are states dealing with that crisis, and what is Washington going to do about it? Does it rely entirely on getting the big health care reform bill passed to fix Medicaid?
No. I mean, I think there are two sets of problems with Medicaid. There are some structural problems with Medicaid, but the crisis you see at the moment is really kind of a funding crisis for Medicaid. Medicaid has always been a very expensive program, and then add to it the recession and the economic stress that states are under, both because they have lower tax receipts and because they have more people who need assistance, they are really getting crushed under this double whammy in the Medicaid program. So they're looking for relief from the federal government, continuing relief from the federal government with their Medicaid burden. Now, the stimulus bill included money for the four states to help them with their Medicaid burdens. That money is pretty much expiring at this point. There's a jobs bill that's pending in Congress, and there was some hope that an extension of the funds for Medicaid program in the states would be included. So far, it hasn't. It was included as part of health care reform, which we know is stalled at the moment. So our state's going to get some more federal dollars to help with their Medicaid burden. I suspect that probably is on the horizon, but the path forward on that is not clear at all, and states are clearly hurting.
Well, and so you've got Medicaid, and then, of course, the other big sort of fiscally untamed animal in all this is Medicare. And what's going to happen with Medicare over the longer term if we have a bill or if we don't have a bill?
Well, I think we all know the ugly truth, but nobody really likes to talk about it very much, and that is the deficits in this country are driven by three big expensive items: the Medicare, Medicaid, health care programs, the Social Security system, and our defense requirements. That's the overwhelming bulk of the budget. And if you're going to really seriously talk about deficit reduction, those are the three places you have to go. President Obama was sort of criticized a little bit for his spending freeze, for it being sort of just an incremental step towards deficit reduction, but that's because you've got to take on the big program. So Medicare and the rate of growth in Medicare just has to be brought down, has to be shrunk. The health reform bill had a number of ways of doing that. some new payment methodologies, some new incentives in the program. Probably not enough. We're going to have to do more of that. We're going to have to squeeze the Medicare program if we're going to address the deficit, and
let me ask you about that, John. You know, one of the things that the health care reform bill was predicated on that I know Republicans are now squawking about is sort of ending a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicare process, and that was how you got to the score that the president wanted and that the Democratic leadership wanted. And some people are now asking, and I expect the Republicans might make a big deal about this at the summit with the president in 2 weeks, you know, if we can save these hundreds of billions of dollars that you're saying we can save with Medicare, why not squeeze that out of the system first before we determine the reforms that will come, and we'll have the money then. We'll know we have the money then to pay for it if we've squeezed those inefficiencies out of the system. What am I missing there? Because I know it can't be that easy.
Well, realizing that people are speeding, but stopping everybody from speeding or giving everybody who speeds a speeding ticket, it's difficult. So yes, there's waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicare program, and certainly a lot more can be done to squeeze that out. But that's also a factor of how much enforcement you have and how effective that is. And you're also going to need a lot more prosecutors and a lot more auditors and a lot more examiners. And there isn't a simple switch you throw that just gets rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. But I think Republicans have a point, which is you ought to make the program, you know, sort of more efficient. I don't think that's a reason not to address some of the other problems in healthcare. But you can certainly say there's no reason not to do that, and that's certainly a first step forward. It shouldn't in and of itself, I think, be a shield to address the problems of people who don't have health insurance or some of the other problems in the Medicare program.
Last question. We got about 2 minutes left. Everyone complains about premiums going up so fast. Give me the quick reason why that is, and will health care reform have anything to do with changing that?
Well, we can't sustain the rate of premium increases that we have been having. The insurance companies partially say we've been partially having to increase premiums because a lot of people are dropping their health insurance during the recession. They tend to be the healthier people. People who are sick don't drop their health insurance, so we're getting fewer premium dollars and our costs are going up. I suspect there's some legitimacy to that. On the other hand, they're turning some very, very nice profits, so I think they're also sort of squeezing the system. We're going to have to find a lot more efficient ways of delivering health care. That means probably more nurse practitioners and others, and we're going to have to change some of the payment incentives. It's not just defensive medicine, although we ought to change that too. It's not everybody's going to be able to afford the most cutting-edge, high-tech technology we've got out there. Some of it's just too expensive.
Well, John, we're going to have to leave things there. We'll have you back as more developments warrant here in the weeks and months ahead. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about the state of financial reform in Congress. Keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Thank you, Kevin.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, @pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, as the economic recession lingers, more and more folks have trouble with one of their primary financial obligations, and that has to do, of course, with their mortgages and how to avert foreclosure. We have with us to talk a little bit about what's going on in that area, Micah Green, who is our foremost guest of a peer here on the show to talk about financial issues in Capitol Hill, the things that are pending in financial reform legislation. Today we're going to talk about this issue that was featured in the Wall Street Journal this week. Micah was quoted talking about how housing activists and mortgage investors are working together on the foreclosure problem. So Micah, first, I know you're joining us from snowbound Washington. I hope you are warm there. John Jonas, our last guest, was drinking hot chocolate. Perhaps you're drinking something a little stronger now that it's later in the afternoon.
Yeah, well, financial issues drive you to drink earlier.
There you go. Well, this mortgage foreclosure problem, that's one that's been with us for at least 2 years now. And early in the Obama administration, go back about 12 months, they were presenting a plan to modify mortgages and help folks out. How is that program going now that we're in the 13th month of the Obama administration?
Well, there is no question that the foreclosure problem has been growing, not shrinking. And it's been one that, you know, as you said, for the last couple of years, both the prior administration and the current administration have been trying to wrap their arms around. You know, the efforts of these last 2 years has been more about how do you get financial institutions to modify the terms of a person's existing mortgage. And that's proven quite difficult, in large part because the infrastructure set up in the mortgage market has not been about mortgage modification. It's really been more about mortgage origination. So the banks that service these loans have had to create this totally new infrastructure. And then it's been complicated. It's been complicated by several factors, including the fact that if you modify the homeowner's first mortgage, their first lien, but you don't modify their second lien or their home equity loan, have you really helped them in affordability? And secondly, even if you modify their existing or current payment, if their home is, if their mortgage is underwater, which means they owe much more on their mortgage than their home is worth, what is the actual incentive for them to continue to pay that mortgage? And with different types of mortgages, like pay option arms and others, the problem just seems to be getting worse and worse, irrespective of the programs that both this and the prior administration have been trying to implement.
Yeah, this question of being underwater really hit home with me last week. I was talking to a friend in Detroit who was trying to refinance his house that he bought about 4 or 5 years ago so that they could free up some cash for a variety of other purposes. And they bought a home for about $300,000 in one of the nicer suburbs up in Detroit. And when they went to refinance, it was appraised at $150,000. And so you say, my God, I mean, you'd almost be better off abandoning it that case and starting over. So how significant is it that so many homeowners across the country, but certainly concentrated in pockets, your Southern Californias, your Michigans, maybe your Floridas or places I know have real problems, they're underwater, they owe more than the home is worth. How significant a societal problem is that for us going forward?
Well, it's a very big problem, not only for the homeowner, but also for the real estate market generally. I think everyone is, you know, I mean, we long for the days when your home was your largest asset that continued to rise in value every year. Everyone felt richer every year when their home, when their neighbor's home was selling for more than they than their home, you know, cost them. And so it's a problem for all homeowners, but it's particularly a problem for homeowners that really can't afford the mortgage that they currently have. And some mortgages, like a pay option ARM, depend on the ability to refinance that mortgage. And if you can't refinance it for the very reason you said, you know, that's going to lead to potentially a foreclosure. So there's almost two classes of homeowners underwater. There's those homeowners, you know, frankly, like probably many people that are listening to this program, who find themselves where their home has gone down in value, but it's never even crossed their mind to stop paying their mortgage. They're going to continue to pay their mortgage because that's what you do, and you don't want to hurt your credit rating. Then there's those homeowners who are underwater and owe more than their home is worth, and that's impacting their ability to pay their mortgage. And investors believe that you've got to deal with that latter part because, you know, if you don't, it'll continue to put a drag on the entire system.
Well, now we get into there's a group out there called the Mortgage Investors Coalition, and there's some members that would appear to support a program that would reduce the principal amount for a troubled homeowner. And I want you to talk a little bit about that effort, and also maybe a little bit when you read about this, especially in places like the Wall Street Journal, you start to see terms like moral hazard thrown around and what it means when you start saying to one neighbor on the street, yeah, we're going to reduce the amount you owe because you bought at the top end of the market, but Joe down the street, you bought 5 years ago, and you're still going to be stuck with your full amount. Can you talk to us a little bit about the Investors Coalition and what they're doing on the principal?
Sure. The Mortgage Investors Coalition, which I am blessed to be able to do work for, is a group of large institutional investors who have significant holdings in non-agency mortgage-backed securities, which means they hold, in the mortgage market, there's those securities that are bought by Freddie and Fannie, and then there are those that are held by private investors. And the Mortgage Investors Coalition is made up of those private investors, and they are holding, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of mortgages, that are either perfectly performing or not performing, near default, at default, should be in foreclosure. And they look at this whole situation and say, clearly as investors, you know, a foreclosure, you know, is probably, you know, going to result in the least amount of return for them, and that there are alternatives for foreclosure, and that's why they've come up with a proposal to reduce the principal for a troubled homeowner's mortgage, because if you don't reduce the principal, you'll never deal with their problem long term. But you raise the issue of moral hazard, and the issue of moral hazard is a real issue, because if your neighbor down the street is not paying their mortgage, and somehow through some private sector effort or through some governmental program, they're given relief, but you, living in the same kind of house, are paying your mortgage, and yet the value of your home's gone down, is that fair? The problem is that if your neighbor is forced to be foreclosed upon because they just simply cannot pay, it will affect the value of your home in a very, very negative way. And, you know, there's no question that when you look at the homeowner who can't afford to pay their mortgage, you've got to look at, you know, how much credit card debt they have, how many car loans they have, and whether or not they have a home equity loan on it, you know, as you're looking at the first mortgage amount. But at the end of the day, if they're still going to end up in foreclosure, something's got to give, and that's why investors believe that coming up with a program where the first lien would be reduced, the second lien, which is typically held by the bank, would be reduced, and then you lead them to be refinanced into a new mortgage that's properly sized and properly turned, you've succeeded in helping the homeowner, but frankly, from the investor standpoint, the homeowner and the investor have identical perspectives here because they're both in a mortgage currently that they shouldn't and don't want to be in.
Well, you talked about the investor and you've talked about the homeowner. I'm curious about the banks because, you know, as you sort of described this situation, the bank or the note holder, whoever they are at the end of the day, and maybe it is that investor who's bought, you know, some sophisticated financial instruments based on mortgages that are packaged together. But, you know, there's got to be a significant hit to some business somewhere that comes with the write-down of all this property. If you go ahead and reduce the principal amount I owe on my home, I see and read conflicting things about whether or not taking care of that now will shore up the bank system or if it will create more uncertainty. What's your feeling there?
Well, you've hit on a very important issue in this whole process because banks, for assets that they hold in their portfolios, do not have to what's called mark them to market, which means, you know, that a mortgage on the books of a bank or a home equity loan on the books of a bank is probably being held on that institution's books at a value that is not what its current market value is. It's more likely significantly higher than their current market value. An investor, like the investors in the Mortgage Investors Coalition, actually have to mark those assets to market. So the first lien that an investor is saying reduce the principal, they've already marked it at a much lower value than what they paid for it. So the hit on their balance sheet is much less. Where the bank, if they have to take a write down, will obviously get a hit. But the fact is though, if you do not deal with the second lien, the home equity loan, you're really not dealing with the affordability for the homeowners. So, you know, the question is there some way that the government can help here? Is there some way that they can help with either, you know, some form of accounting relief in this situation to allow them to write off that loss over time? I mean, that's not really for the mortgage investor, the private mortgage investor, to decide. But there's no question that you just simply can't focus on the first lien. You've got to get the holder of the subordinate liens part of the equation because that's part of the affordability factor for the homeowner.
Very interesting. Well, Mike, I've got about 1 minute left. Can I get a 60-second update on where financial reform negotiations are in the Senate?
Sure. I mean, there's some interesting developments today. I mean, Senator Dodd and Senator Shelby have been talking for weeks about this issue, and I think they reached an impasse principally over the issue of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, where the original administration position was to create a new agency. But it sounds like, at least from reports today, that Senator Dodd has continued talking to other Republicans, including Senator Corker from Tennessee, and that there's actually some significant progress being made at trying to develop a bipartisan package on that issue. But what remains to be seen is how Senator Shelby, who is the ranking Republican on the Senate Banking Committee, will respond to those reports, because he's obviously an important player in this process. But it does seem to be that talks, even irrespective of the 45 to 50 inches of snow Washington has gotten, that talks on the financial services reform have continued at a high level between Senator Dodd and Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee.
Very good. Well, I know there's a joke in there somewhere about how much snow D.C. has gotten and when hell freezes over, but I can't quite figure it out before we go to break here, Micah.
I would just say this one thing, that in, you know, a year ago, Washington became the financial capital of the world, and now it's also the snow capital of the world.
Well, we're happy to be the former. We're not so excited about being the latter. Micah, thanks for joining us. Hope you get dug out in time to get to work sometime before spring break. We're going to be back in just a minute with the hot topics of the day from Capitol Hill.
Thanks, Kevin.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, good show so far, everybody. We had a very interesting conversation about non-compete clauses and what you need to know as a business person to make sure that your employees aren't leaving you to become your competitors in the future, where, if at all possible. Talked a little bit about health care reform and whether or not what we're going to see in 2 weeks between the President and the House Republicans at the White House will just be kabuki theater, or whether or not there's a chance for a substantive agreement to come out that will allow us to get health care reform restarted. And then we talked about the mortgage market and the state of financial reform, which I think is fascinating stuff. What Micah talked about at the end there with Senator Bob Corker perhaps sort of jumping the fence to work with Chairman Chris Dodd of the Banking Committee on financial reform is an interesting story on so many levels. Typically, you don't see a younger senator like Senator Corker, who hasn't been in the chamber that long, still in his first term, jump over the more senior folks on his side to begin negotiations on a bipartisan package. And so it will be interesting to see what Senator Shelby, who the lead Republican on that committee is, what he does, and whether or not Senator Corker sort of gets taken aside by the Republican leadership and told, hey, you know, that's not what we want to do here. It's a very interesting and smart strategy by Senator Dodd to reach out to Corker because, again, with the 59-41 breakdown in the United States Senate, you really only need one Republican to come along with you for the ride to get that filibuster-proof supermajority if, in fact, you're keeping all of your Democratic players on your side of the fence on any given issue. So if Senator Dodd can bring Senator Corker along on a deal, while you may see financial reform accelerate ahead of health care reform on the agenda for the United States Senate this spring to get to the president's desk. A couple things to talk about. I'm just back from the Super Bowl, and I'm holed up south of D.C., so I'm not part of the great snowstorm of 2010, much to the chagrin of so many of my friends. I know for, some of my colleagues from the Voice America Business Network were down broadcasting live from the Super Bowl last week. I was jealous of them. Perhaps the network will send me next year to talk about the business and the politics of football. But I had a great time just going down for the football part of football, despite the fact that I'm a Colts fan. My wife and I had terrific seats and a fabulous time at the game. If you're a fan, I definitely recommend going once in your lifetime. And the business of the Super Bowl is just phenomenal to sort of look at from a distance. So I hope you enjoyed the game. A couple things from Capitol Hill. As you probably know, John Murtha, a powerful member of the House Democratic leadership, died earlier this week due to complications from surgery, gallbladder surgery that he had in January. That's going to have an impact on a number of levels. Look for Murtha's name to be invoked, just as Ted Kennedy's was in the health care reform debate, if health care reform actually gets back to the House floor this year, since it was a medical error that seems to have led to his death. Murtha was the chairman of the powerful House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee and a leader in the earmarking movement, and somebody who had been under House ethics investigation for the ties between his earmarks and campaign contributions that were being given to him. That was someone Republicans had been targeting as a high priority target in the 2010 election cycle, and they were hoping to hang his ethical challenges around the neck of the Democratic Party. They don't have that to do anymore. Now both parties have another open seat election. Looks like it'll take place in May when the state of Pennsylvania has a previously scheduled special election time, and that district will basically have one election in May and then one election in November. That'll be a very expensive race. That in a district that President Bush and Senator John McCain both carried in the past. So it could be one that actually flips. Keep in mind, though, that the congressional Democrats have won every open House seat race so far this cycle, and they will certainly spend the money and resources to find a good candidate and to try and hold the Murtha seat. Now, this week has been one. Here we are. We're in mid-February, and we've seen a lot of retirements on both sides of the aisle in the House of Representatives this week. Lincoln Diaz-Balart from South Florida announcing today at lunchtime he is retiring. Perhaps his brother, who represents an adjoining district, is actually going to move into Lincoln's district and run because it's a safer Republican seat in what is a changing demographic down there for Republicans. Also, Vernon Ehlers from Michigan announcing he's retiring after 10 terms. He announced that retirement just days after a conservative filed to run against him in the primary, saying that he'd spent too long in Washington. And on the Democratic side, Diane Watson of the Los Angeles area announcing her retirement in what is really probably a fairly safe seat for Democrats to hold. The Ehlers seat is probably very safe for Republicans to hold, and the Diaz-Balart seat perhaps a little less safe, and I would bet that the Democrats will spend some money and some effort to try and take that seat away, given the changing demographics in South Florida. But let's talk about what the retirements actually mean. Here it is, February. Most incumbents want to decide by the end of the year whether or not, end of last year, whether or not they're going to run for re-election. The fact that these folks are retiring now is a sign that incumbents continue to see extremely bad numbers in polling data, and that we're entering perhaps an unprecedented cycle for this generation, perhaps the first new media generation-driven cycle that is going to really put unprecedented pressure on incumbents to define how they're different than all the problems in Washington. And your failure to define how you're not part of the problem in Washington makes you vulnerable. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see another handful of House retirements here before spring break time, with some people realizing that they just don't have the fight in them to go raise the money and work the local campaign events needed to stay in office when such an anti-incumbent mood is upon us. You also see a little of that in the Republican primaries that are really starting to get interesting. I'll point out two Senate races for you. Florida, where Mario Rubio, the former Speaker of the House there, is running against the incumbent, sitting governor, Charlie Crist, for the Republican nomination for the seat Mel Martinez has vacated. All of the establishment got behind Crist early on. Rubio was thought to be nothing more than a spoiler. Now the race shows Rubio ahead in the polling data, and he's starting to raise the same amount of money as Crist. You look at Kentucky, again, Jim Bunning, Republican retiring. The Republican establishment got behind Trey Grayson, the Secretary of State, early, put a lot of money into him. And here's a guy named Rand Paul, a doctor and the son of Congressman Ron Paul, who ran a quixotic campaign for president in 2008 that was extraordinarily well-funded by the grassroots. Well, Rand Paul has inherited his father's grassroots ability to reach out and dial up for money and dial up for passionate supporters. And he's not only raising more money than Trey Grayson, the establishment Republican, but he's also seems to be leading and doing just as well in the polls against his likely Democratic opponents. Again, another sign the grassroots is rising up, saying we're not happy with Washington, we don't care who you are. If you're Washington's candidate, it's not necessarily a good time to be Washington's candidate. You need to be candidate from us. You see that mostly on the Republican side, not a whole lot of evidence from that of people running to the left of established candidates that are Democrats so far, but perhaps we will see it. Now, it has been an extraordinarily quiet week in Washington with the government shut down, and perhaps there are lots of benefits of that. We will be back next week when we expect Washington to have dug out and figured out what's going on, and we'll have lots to talk about in the halls of Congress and in Washington, D.C. Until then, have a great weekend.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.